I don't think of rabbits when I hear Bright Eyes, but that might be because I didn't see the film.
Do you just think of pain?
Of who?
Pain.
Yes, I just think of suffering. Bright Eyes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, welcome to Off Air. I was going to do this yesterday and I completely forgot. We ran out of time on the radio show, but Catelyn Moran had written a very funny article for The Times about a train journey between London and Birmingham. And
was it on time? Was the service superb? Did the air conditioning work and the Wi-Fi came on first time?
What do you think?
Probably.
But she ended up just feeling really embarrassed because there were Japanese tourists on the train. And the Japanese tourists were finding it all very difficult to deal with. She says, a Japanese couple sit on the floor beside me. I've travelled by train in Japan. They serve delightful ekiben boxes of sushi as you go past Mount Fuji at 320 kilometres per hour. Whereas on that journey between London, Euston and Birmingham, you don't get as fast as that. It doesn't go up to that speed. Not 320 kph. No.
I'm not sure I'm bold enough to take 320 kph. I like the way you say it. Are you going to hive off into transport broadcasting? Because that really rolled off your tongue.
Well, I don't like to boast, but I am the person who failed the audition for AA Roadwatch. I did go for that job.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, the way you do the AA-sponsored traffic and travel reports.
Oh, on the radio?
On the radio. I went for that.
On the M25 this morning?
I went for a job there. And I didn't get it.
It's down to two lanes by the Dantson Interchange, all of that. Yeah.
God, Manchester, and all those other places that seem to crop up on the track. Anyway, don't know why I'm reminiscing, because they turned me down.
Well, there was a thing, wasn't there, in this country this weekend that the M25 was closed for the first time in 40 years?
Oh, it was big news.
And
wasn't
it was meant to be. It was termed Carmageddon,
yeah,
because it was going to be so appalling, and there were these diversions going through little Surrey villages and stuff, and everybody was warned to stay at home. And some clanger of a bloke said, "Stay at home and do some DIY instead," which is not very helpful if it's your job to be out and about. But anyway, it didn't turn into Carmageddon because everybody did just find alternative ways to go places. And it was incredibly calm. And there was just a very funny report of somebody had filmed the bridge where the press were allowed to be to film this Carmageddon.
Chaos.
And it was just silence underneath. Like, just all of these film crews.
See, sometimes Britain delivers or doesn't, depending on what you want to see. But we're in a strange place in this country at the moment because people are still... We're not going to talk about that woman who's occupying these huge amounts of media space. We're not going to talk about it. This is the place where you won't hear anything.
Well, I cannot keep up...
About what's really going on.
I can't keep up with where you are on the Kateometer because sometimes I think you have actually been waking yourself up an hour early so you can get all the news. But if you don't want to mention her, that's absolutely fine.
I've officially got to the point where I just can't take any more of this.
Have you?
And I can't take any more of people saying that it can't take any more, because that's consuming an enormous amount of airtime. And then there are the people who say, "Well, I was never interested. I've never been remotely interested in where she is or what's happening."
But why
to
don't
her.
You believe people who say that? Because there just are a lot of people who genuinely don't.
We're not sure the stats back it up. Because if you look at the most read articles, she's always it's always at number one. Look, I don't think she's been abducted by aliens.
No.
I mean, although, you know.
I think if you ever wanted to dispel the Disney princess myth, just look at her life.
Yeah, it's not much of one, is it?
No, not at the moment.
No. Anyway, I was very grateful to the listener who emailed yesterday about anal cancer and asking if we could mention it on air. And actually, we did. I don't know whether the listener was able to hear it, but we did it on the radio programme yesterday and we featured it in our health news. So you can listen back to Times Radio on the Times Radio app. It doesn't cost you anything. And that would be at around about, it was about 3:20 on Tuesday afternoon that we talked about it and we talked about the symptoms, because our correspondent has had it. She has recovered, but she just believes that perhaps not many people know much about it.
I've left my emails. I brought in Gino De Campo instead. I keep doing this, Eve. I'm just really, really, really sorry.
Okay.
Eve runs faster than I do. I can't really run across the newsroom. I fear that some terrible thing would happen. I could do just a couple of comments from the Twitter.
Go on.
So Jim is joining in with our search for merchandise on British burnt out pier allotment, or whatever we're going to call our three-word merchandising opportunity.
This is our tribute to Megan's, gosh, it still hasn't stuck, American Riviera Orchard.
Well done.
Wow.
Which Jim calls American Ranch El Dorado.
Yeah. Okay.
Just give me. Yep. Well, he says it's just got to be Jane and Fee tea towels, because we were musing on the demise of the informative tea towel. So we need to write some things of certainty on tea towels. I'll take them all, Eve. I'll take them all.
You've got that poor girl running around after you all the time.
That's not true.
Jackie says, I was listening to your radio show today, but I was triggered when you played Art Garfunkel's Bright Eyes. I was taken to see the film of Watership Down as an 8-year-old and suffered 6 weeks of night terrors after the violence of General, and I confess I don't remember, General Woundwort. Fast forward 30 years to Christmas 2009, and I was on holiday in Yorkshire with my best friends and our dog. The dog caught a rabbit in the garden, and simultaneously my best friend and I broke into a rendition of Bright Eyes to accompany our husbands trying to rescue the rabbit as the dog unceremoniously dispatched it in front of us. Fun times, says Jackie. Thank you. Yeah, that song is, I find it, I don't think of rabbits when I hear Bright Eyes, but that might be because I didn't see the film.
Do you just think of pain?
Of who?
Pain.
Yes, I just think of suffering. Bright Eyes. I really do love Art Garfunkel's voice, but he and Paul Simon massively fell out, didn't they?
They do not get on.
No, and that is, it's a real shame, that, isn't it? Are they both alive?
They are still alive, right. And I did see a documentary, it might even be the Imagine one, maybe it's the Imagine one, I don't know. It was detailing Paul Simon's contribution to music, and the inserts from Art Garfunkel were beautifully edited.
Right.
But basically, it was Paul Simon saying, I wrote everything.
And he sung
and I,
it.
And I sung everything.
Oh, okay, right.
And, you know, there really wasn't a huge contribution. And then Art would pop up saying completely the opposite. But it just was one of those wonderful, wonderful TV edits. But it's terrible when you just don't, you don't want them to fall out, do you?
You don't, actually. And I would say Art Garfunkel's album Breakaway is still one of my favourite albums. Some lovely songs on Breakaway. I'm not going to say it, but just explore Breakaway. It's a beautiful album. But on the subject of friends who do seem to be genuinely friendly, unfortunately, I did see the very last episode of The Hairy Bikers last night on BBC Two, and it was really beautifully done, really, really well handled. But it was properly sad. Obviously, Dave Myers has now died, and they went down to Cornwall in the final episode. It was really lovely. If other people saw it, I'm sure they'll agree with me. It was really nice.
On your other TV recommendation, The Gone.
Oh yes,
on BBC Four. I'm not enjoying the goat theme.
Oh, the sacrificial thing.
Yes,
yeah, we'll get over it.
And no, it's not very nice. And you know when they say no animal is harmed, which I completely believe, but it's dead. Was it always dead?
Aren't there places where they can recreate dead things?
Oh, I hope it's a recreation.
I'm sure it will be. Because, like you, I don't want animals being killed for television.
No, I don't like that theme of, you know, ritualistic abuse. It crops up in lots and lots of stuff at the moment. as I think it's a kind of, it's almost like it's a go-to theme in dark times, because we've explored all of the other dark times. So let's go to some really weird ritualistic abuse where we could just make it as dark as the human mind could ever be.
I know that they're all, I mean, you're right. We do try to retreat into suggestions of Satanism, don't we? I would just find it very difficult to keep a straight face at one of those events if I was asked to attend one. You just think about the gathering in the middle of a wood in the middle of the night in the English countryside to
I know what you mean.
Sacrifice a dormouse or something. I just couldn't be bothered.
They're always wearing kind of,
hoods and
bear skins and ponchos. And you think, yeah, if you pan down, you've probably just got some trainers and socks on under that, because you're not walking through the woods
wearing a sensible fleece.
Yeah. This one comes from Janine, who says, I've just started watching The Gong. Gripping so far. Thank you for the recommendation.
Oh, good.
Just wondered that Jane said she'd never seen a TV drama set in New Zealand. And the one that I was struggling to reach for, Janine has correctly identified as Top of the Lake with Elizabeth Moss, directed by Jane Campion. Absolutely brilliant. Although it was on a while back, and Janine thinks about 2015. That's quite a challenging watch as well, because it's got some themes of not very nice things happening to women, but it was really, really extraordinary.
Right.
On a lighter note, Amy is a dedicated listener from Australia. She was chuckling at our efforts to try and emulate the Duchess of Sussex. What about British coastal woodland, says Amy? You could sell bluebell-scented candles, peat-infused face masks. Can't do peat.
Why not?
You're not allowed to dig up the
peat. It's not environmentally.
No. But I know what you mean, Amy. We'd find something else, maybe just a little bit of mud. Some mud from London fields. Bramble jelly. I envisage a range of linen products that pay homage. Is that right? The right way to say it?
Homage,
thank you. To the hedgehog, a once ubiquitous but now sadly endangered woodland icon. Perhaps you could one-up Megan in the charity stakes by donating some of the proceeds to efforts to save the hedgehog. So we don't know that they're not going to donate a substantial amount of that money to charity. We shouldn't prejudge that.
Well, let's prejudge it.
Amy ends up by saying, I was also thinking you could do something fancy with fruit, but perhaps you could just sell fresh apples and berries as they are for massively inflated prices. This would be the ultimate tribute to Harry and Meghan's status as grifters.
Look, we've always we're actually substantially less mean to Harry and Meghan than lots of other people in the media.
I think I was the last remaining supporter.
You were very loyal for a very long time.
Really long time.
And I've just managed to convince you that they may not be 1,000,000% perfect. But nevertheless, I think they have. Look, they're doing their thing. Let's leave them to it. Like you, Fee, has been to the Garrick Club. This was a topic.
I love this one.
Topic for us yesterday, because the Guardian newspaper has finally tracked down a list of the members of the Garrick Club. Now, I mean, it's great journalism. I wasn't actually losing sleep over not being aware of who was in the Garrick Club and who wasn't. But a lot of men are, and they are influential, of these geezers. I've been inside the club as a guest, and I rather let myself down. I was in my 20s, and I was a very junior barrister who'd been involved in a long drugs importation gang-type trial with lots of other barristers, all male apart from me. It was traditional at the end of the trial to take the judge to dinner as a guest of the barristers, both sides, particularly if everyone had got on well. This is new to me. Is that okay? It was new to me too, says Catherine. That's very strange. A bit clubbable old boys type stuff. I was a grammar school girl, but actually the whole thing was a lot of fun. The QCs, as they were then called, were all members. Like Fee, I vaguely remember the inside, lots of wood panelling and heavy drapes. Dinner was in a private room. I don't know if this was because of me being vaguely female. There was champagne, fine wines, port. We toasted the judge, who was ironically not present at the dinner because he had pleurisy. Not sure why I remember that detail 25 years later. I was extremely refreshed and weaved my way to the ladies' powder room, only I got lost on the way back to the dining room and found myself creeping around the apparently deserted Garrick Club. It was a Friday evening, it must have been very late, and a distinguished member of the club, Sir John Gielgud, noted thespian, had died that week. I found myself by a bronze of the great man, and as if by magic, the maitre d' from the dining room appeared and escorted me firmly but politely back to our room. I noticed I was minus one hold-up, which incongruously I'd lost in the loos. The rest of the evening I haven't committed to memory, but I woke up next morning fully clothed with a Garrick side plate. It has All the World's a Stage painted on it in my handbag.
Brilliant.
Oh, by the way, this gets even better. I am now a judge.
I know.
I am still waiting to be taken out for dinner.
It's fantastic.
Right. Just to say, we're not going to mention your name, but we both very much hope we come up before you.
And we'll take you out to dinner.
What's that? There used to be, what did they call it? The Masonic sign of distress. That if you were a Mason and you were in the dock and you found yourself up before a beak, you could tell the judge that you were also a Mason by waggling something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was.
What? So do you know what the Mason's handshake is?
Well, I think I do, but I could be wrong, isn't it?
Is it the middle finger down?
Tickle, don't you?
Yes.
Tickle with your middle finger.
Is
that right?
So you tickle the other person's
palm. Not being funny,
palm.
But if we both know, it's not much use, is it?
It's not, no. But nobody's ever going to use it on us.
I mean, I do the special Tufty Club handshake.
I still think it is one of the most unexplained areas of weirdness in our society, that the Masons exist and are unchallenged and, you know, to our point about the Garrick Club, I think you can visit the lodge, can't you, as a woman, but you can't be admitted to the lodges yet?
They have, well, I think they have ladies' nights at a lot of lodges.
But can you be a Freemason
as
a woman?
I still think that it's only men. But if you are in central London, you can visit their incredible headquarters on, is it Great Queen Street?
And just the most mind-boggling mansion of devotion to Freemasonry. It's like a cathedral in there, isn't it?
I'm going to say it's properly strange.
Yeah.
Bits of,
I tell you what, if you are a Mason, or if you're with a Mason, you'd like to know.
Or you've maybe, I think richer territory might be if you've been married to a Mason.
Yes.
Or if you've been to a ladies' night.
Yeah.
What goes on there?
And it's very easy to be cynical about it and just assume, because it is all so secretive, that very odd things are happening. But you know, tell us that they aren't, and with
reassure
proof,
us.
Please.
Yeah. There is a kind of old folks Masonic home near where my parents live. So they look out. They continue to look out for members as they decline.
So lots of groups do that, don't they? So,
yeah, and you could argue that's perfectly okay.
I think that's the benign side of it. Mm. It's the prevalence of Freemasons within certain professions that's always troubled me.
Well, it was the police, wasn't it? And the judiciary. Anyway, as Fee says, put our minds at rest.
Yeah.
Or not.
And also some of those ceremonies down at the lodge. I'm not sure about that. Keep doing the good stuff, says Carla, who's a counsellor. There have been lots of very kind, well-handled discussions about death and the death of close and much-loved relatives. In January, I returned from holiday to a letter asking me to phone a solicitor. After checking my identity, they asked me to contact a city council department. The next day, Mr. M, a lovely, deep-voiced gentleman at the city council, told me I was the only surviving relative of a man I'd never met and never wanted to meet, my biological father. The man I'd never met was dead. What would I like to do with the body? After we'd chuckled at not fitting in with societal expectations of death and established it's not legal to put a ne'er-do-well in a wheelie bin, I decided on cremation with no service. I'm 56, and to say that was a weird few days I'd never expected is an understatement, but the weirdness has been compounded by doing a very adult thing alone and not grieving for someone I never knew. Super strange, but an illustration of things that can and do happen. Isn't that a remarkable story?
I thought that was quite remarkable. And as she says, that's strange.
Yep.
To get that phone call out of the blue and to then have to have a word with yourself about how you should be feeling in that moment. How you can't conjure up feeling from nowhere. As she says, she didn't know him.
No. But also to be asked to do something in the event of somebody's death, a parent who hadn't contacted you, hadn't made things right if they'd been wrong, whatever it was.
But
and
really,
obviously,
tragically,
we don't know the full story.
Must have had our correspondent as next of kin.
Yep. So, Carla, I hope you're doing okay. I mean, that really is a remarkable story. And from the way that you tell it, you sound, very sorted about it. But I think we could all understand if you weren't. Sarah sent a very lovely email as well. Just about, you know, silly merchandise and stuff like that. But I just wanted to read out her ending to us, which says, thanks for keeping the pilot light going. And I thought that was just such a really lovely phrase. And I know what you mean. There are some kind of go-to places, aren't there, in favourite authors or TV or radio or whatever it is, that does feel like it's a pilot light.
What, just the constant flicker?
Yes, just, you know, it's just the boiler's on. It works. That's, yeah, I like that.
Can I just say there's no worse sight on earth in midwinter
than no pilot light?
Exactly that. Somebody somewhere should write a poem about that. When you open the door of the airing cupboard or wherever you currently store your boiler and there it's not.
What rhymes with boiler? Spoiler.
Spoiler, yes. I literally don't think anything else does. Toiler? No. No, let's not go there. No.
So it's a short... Well, you could do a limerick, I'm sure.
Now, we live in interesting times and the Irish Taoiseach has resigned today.
Very suddenly.
Well, I think it is a bit of a surprise.
With immediate effect.
With immediate effect, yeah. So I hope he's all right. Yeah, that's Leo Varadkar, but that just reminds me, we've got an email here from an Irish listener, Sarah, who is actually very interested in the subject of funerals. And she says, I listened to the episode with Linda Robson when she described her mother as having a lovely death. And actually, Sarah wonders whether Linda's mum was Irish. She was actually Irish. So that would explain perhaps why the family's approach to the whole thing was pretty positive. And I know that seems strange, but you probably know what I mean. One thing I'm curious about, says Sarah, is funeral etiquette for different nationalities. Perhaps you could throw this out to your listeners. I worked abroad for many years in a multicultural environment. When one of my English colleagues' mother died, the Irish amongst the workforce started preparing to attend the funeral, because that's what we do. I asked my colleague if she could give me the details of the venue. The look on her face when I asked immediately set off alarm bells in my head, and I realised I had obviously overstepped the mark. She replied by saying that as we hadn't been invited to the funeral, we would not be able to attend. Needless to say, this was totally alien to the Irish. I don't know if you know the funeral traditions in Ireland, but in this country, you never get invited to a funeral. You just show up. In fact, if you don't make an appearance, it will be considered as an insult. As a result, funeral attendance can go into the hundreds. I mean, that is really interesting, isn't it? And there is a sort of a stiffness about some English funerals, not all of them, but there is a sort of, you know, really an unpleasant formality. And that's so interesting. I know a lot of Irish people would go out of genuine respect to any funeral. But in England, on the whole, you just don't do that.
No, but I'm going to stand up for the cold comfort of an English funeral. Sometimes I think I have felt it's what I know and it kind of works, and there's something about a chilly church and formality that maybe it is simply that. It is just what I know. So I don't think it's all bad. I don't think we grieve well as a nation.
No.
But that's a different thing. And the very, very simple but slightly kind of contained funeral, which usually happens, doesn't it, in this country, within a couple of weeks, actually.
Can take
somebody
weeks, depending on the time of year.
Yeah. Dying. I think it's... I sometimes think that's the only thing that you're kind of capable of, you know, if you are only recently adjusting to your loss. And then the Thanksgiving service, which seems to be much more of a thing these days. I don't remember anybody having a Thanksgiving service when I was tiny.
No.
But people do tend to do that now, and that's much more liberated
open house.
And everybody's there, and hundreds of people turn up.
But Sarah, seriously, I've got a question. If you are going to, I mean, have lots of hundreds of people turning up at a relative's funeral, are you expected to cater for all of them?
I bet you are.
I mean, you must be. Yeah. And that must be quite an outlay. So you must have lots of funeral insurance plans in Ireland to make sure that you can get enough cheese and pickle sandwiches and sausage rolls for 250 people.
Yeah.
I wouldn't bother. I'd ask people to bring their own.
Right.
Pack a lunch.
In death as in life.
There's a free bar for 10 minutes.
The Carby's generosity. Really, really.
It does have bounds.
Never even started to amaze. Here's Glyn to the teacher who's struggling with the relentless slog of paperwork and admin at her school. I suggest before switching careers completely and ditching what can be the best job ever, she thinks about moving to another school. In my experience, the amount of tedious form filling, tick boxing and detailed marking required of teachers is purely down to the leadership culture of the school. school, which is largely driven by the head teacher. There are lots of realistic and understanding head teachers out there, and I think it would be a great shame for your correspondent to throw away their vacation based on one bad experience. I'm sure she's a great teacher and would be a real loss to the profession. Big shout out to all the dedicated teachers out there. Oh, and could they do something in form time tomorrow about cyber flashing? And it's probably Kick It Out National Veruca Day next Monday, so remind the kids to wear odd socks and bring a £1 donation. And if they could put together an assembly on the situation in Gaza, that would be super. We hear you, Glyn. Yeah. And we're really, really on your side.
Oh, I haven't heard the word Veruca for a while. Welcome back, Veruca. This is from Liz, same subject. I've been reflecting on the teacher from South Wales who feels she's only qualified to teach. I appreciate I've not met her. I suspect given her career to date, she'll be able to demonstrate a huge array of skills, though. Of particular interest is that she worked her way up from nursery nurse to TA to qualified teacher, which is in itself really impressive. I would guess our listener would be able to say the following in terms of her skills: organisational abilities, able to work to tight timescales, able to work alongside others in a team, ability to work under pressure, experience of dealing with conflict, confident communicator, experience of dealing with the public, brackets parents, and I could go on. Consistently reliable, turning up to school day in, day out. I do hope that's helpful. She may need a bit of coaching, re-interviews. Yes, I'm sure that's true. Job interviews, well, I speak from a position of total ignorance about job interviews. When was the last time you had a job interview?
Well, I suppose for it would be my application to join the BBC's trainee reporter scheme in 1992.
Right, OK. Did they ask you where you could see yourself in 5 years?
Yeah, they did.
Did they? OK, and what did you say?
Well, I said in local radio.
Right.
Because that's where I wanted to be.
Right, OK.
Now, we've probably got to get a crack on because I have got an in-depth interview coming up with Gino De Campo.
Yes.
And it's going to be a little bit problematic, actually. You've handed this one over to me.
Well, can I just say, I felt, because you were on holiday next week, I deserve you know, it's time to think of Jane, GoFundMe, and you tussled me to the ground and said nothing will get between me and an interview with Gino De Campo. So I had no choice.
So didn't. But it's going to, so I thought, oh, it would be absolutely fine. It's Gino De Campo. We'll have a lovely, you know, we'll have a lovely bounce
but
around.
But you've talk done about a bit of in-depth research.
Olive oil and, you know, your favourite grandmother who taught you to make pasta.
Oh, how dare you be so cynical about celebrities, honestly.
But it's got quite complicated. For a start, the first piece I read, this is how it starts. Gino De Campo likes to work for only 6 months of each year. The rest of the time he's at his vineyard in Sardinia. He takes a month off at Easter, then all of June, July and August, plus the whole of December for Christmas.
Well, we're lucky to get him today, aren't we?
No, listen to this. That leaves one more month, October. That's just for me, he asserts. I go back to Italy by myself. I need time to think, write fish, ride my motorbike and look after my vineyard. My wife and kids understand. They have no choice. It doesn't matter how much money anyone offers me to stay and work, I'm going. So there's that. But then there's this very difficult headline today because he had to put his restaurant chain into liquidation and he owes the taxman and former staff just under £5 million. So I've got to go there. No, I've got to go there. And he's on to talk about food waste. And now I'm feeling slightly nervous, Jane, because that's a lot to pack in. Can we just talk about penises before we go?
Oh, yeah. OK, I'm not connected.
Jackie says, I just wanted to say a few words in support of Naked Attraction. I agree it is exploitative, as is much reality TV, but it's much more inclusive than Love Island, for example. There are gay, straight and trans daters and many body types. I've watched with my teenage daughter and it's let her see that not all people look like the bikini-clad babes and hunks in trunks on other shows. And quite a few people wrote in to say we should both give Naked Attraction, if not another chance, just a little bit of a break in our condemnation.
Right, OK, we're calling a halt to condemning Naked Attraction out of hand.
OK.
Now, let's bring in today's guest.
Today's guest is a journalist and author of some repute. It's Jenny Kleeman, and her latest book is about a really, really interesting topic. So it's about the price of life. She's gone on an adventure around the world looking into some quite strange parts of life, actually, that we don't often look at. So how much would a hitman cost you? Would you be able to answer that?
I remember someone telling me, and this is a terrible quote, you can get anything done in London for a grand.
Well, actually, a hitman now is, she's found the average price to be £15,500.
Okay.
Yep. But she also looks into other areas, stuff like, you know, how much is the average ransom for a kidnap victim? And some really impressive stuff, actually, around compensation. Because if you lose a loved one to a violent crime, you're entitled to compensation in this country, but in all manner of kind of different matrices. And, you know, some families are not getting as much money as other families. If you were visiting London from a different part of the world, you would be getting something different from your government. Really interesting stuff that we just don't talk about very often. So she came in to see us at Times Towers a couple of days ago, and the book starts off in quite a light-hearted way. And I think actually as a reader, you're quite grateful for that, because there are some other darker moments coming up. So it starts off with her telling the story of a website which is called rentahitman.com.
A guy called Bob set it up, and he was somebody who sort of 20 years ago used to buy domains thinking that he could flip them and sell them for a lot of money. So he'd buy names that he thought other people wanted, .com. And he also was a kind of tech entrepreneur. He wanted to make a kind of search engine optimization business. And so he and some friends had this idea that they would have a business called Rent a Hitman, as in hire somebody who can get hits for your website. So given that he was someone who was really used to buying domains, he bought rentahitman.com. But then the business never really got off the ground, and it just became another one of these websites that sat in his portfolio of names. He put it up for sale. He put a kind of not even a clickable link, but like a cartoon on the homepage saying, this page is for sale, this domain is for sale, contact rentahitman.com. And yeah, he forgot about it. And then 2 years later, he checked the contact rentahitman.com inbox, and it was full of messages from people who were looking for contract killing, who wanted to pay people to kill people.
And these people weren't being shy about it,
no,
were they? So one of them was it a woman in Canada?
She was a British woman who was in Canada at that point.
She wanted to take out three people in the Cotswolds.
In the Cotswolds, yes. And she was very persistent about it. So Bob had this kind of, he was sort of fascinated by these emails, and he decided the best way to deal with them was to reply and say, do you still need our services? Do you want me to put you in touch with a field operative? And if they replied, he decided he would put them in touch with them. He would put the police in touch with them. And
yeah, I mean, we're talking about this in an almost lighthearted way, and that's how the book starts. But of course, that's an incredibly, incredibly serious thing. And in fact, Bob has probably saved the lives of hundreds of people, hasn't
yes.
he? Because he kept the site going and dobbed people in when they got in touch.
Of course, the people who fall into Bob's inbox are not very smart. They're the sort of people who will go to rentahitman.com and click on a link. And when you go to that website, it's obviously a bit of a joke. So as Bob himself says, he only catches the low-hanging fruit. But if there are that many people prepared to do it, how many other people are prepared to go even further with much more serious characters? So the point of that chapter was really to say that murder for hire is a lot more mundane than you think.
How do you arrive at the figure that the average cost of a hitman is £15,180? It's quite specific, Jenny.
It is very specific. So I spoke to some academics who've done some studies on this, and they looked at, it's not massively scientific, these criminologists, but they looked at the reported prices charged by people who've been caught. So, of course, we only know about unsuccessful hitmen, the one that have gone to prison, whose stories are reported in newspapers or revealed in the courts. And they looked at the cost of the average British hitman, and the cheapest was £200. Some prices went up to £100,000. But the kind of hitmen in our popular imaginations, the ones that are dressed like James Bond and appear and disappear without us noticing. We don't really know very much about them because they tend not to be caught.
Yeah. And the rest of the book really, I think, tells us much more about the cost of a victim's life, doesn't it? Not the criminal's life. And one of the most depressing stories is actually that of Sarah Zelenak, who was murdered in the London Bridge terrorist attacks. Can you tell us a bit more about her?
She was 19 years old. She was an au pair in London in 2017. And she was killed in the first of the two London Bridge terror attacks, where three terrorists drove a van across London Bridge. They killed two people with a van, and then the van crashed at the top near Borough Market. They got out of the van and they stabbed many other people, killing six of them. And I chose this as an example of how unfair criminal injury compensation is, because of the eight victims, they were from many different countries. And I knew that if you're killed in a terrorist attack, your family will get a massively different payment according to where you're from. So I thought that this would be a good case study. But when I investigated it, I found out it wasn't just where the victims were from that was the determining factor in how much compensation their families got. It was also how they were killed. And the families of those killed by the van were able to get probably, I mean, it's estimated to be, it's never been revealed, but it's in the ballpark of over £1 million each in compensation, those two people. Whereas the families of those who were stabbed by the same people only seconds later just got whatever was statutory compensation from their country. So in the case of the one British victim, his family would have got £11,000.
It is such a disturbing disparity, isn't it? And really shows the whole point that you're trying to make in the book, you know, who decides the value of a life. But I think people would also think that it's just quite distasteful for our government not to have redressed some of that balance. You know, the fact that Hertz paid out because they're a big company and there was an insurance policy running on that van, but those other poor people who died that night got really nothing, actually. £11,000 is nothing.
Through doing the reporting on it, I realised actually it's quite a useful tool for showing injustice, for showing where systems aren't working. And, you know, when compensation is unfair, what happens is charitable contributions tend to make up the difference when people aren't eligible for compensation or when people are really facing hardship because of it. But the government payouts in criminal injury compensation, it's still our money. It's just collected through taxes rather than through charitable donations. So it still falls back on us. And it is just incredibly unfair that this is the system. And also that the amounts of criminal injury compensation haven't been adjusted since 2012. So they haven't been adjusted for inflation. They haven't been adjusted when all of these inconsistencies have been revealed.
And how does the system even work? I mean, if a child or a teenager is killed, is the compensation scheme looking at that entire life that they would have had ahead of them?
Not at all. And that's the interesting thing, is when the NHS works out whether or not to fund a drug, it will look at the number of quality adjusted life years that drug will add to a person's life. So if it's an intervention that would save the life of a child, they'll pay a lot more money for it than somebody in middle age, for example. But when it comes to a child being killed in a terrorist attack or in a road accident even, the compensation is always the same. It's the same figure for someone at the beginning or the end of their life.
And do you think, from the people that you met in writing the book, that one of the problems is they are just dealing with so much, so many other things, and the grief of losing a loved one, that actually the power to protest, to change a system, would understandably be really beyond them?
Yeah, it's the last thing on their minds. And also, there is a sense of community among the people who are killed in a terror, who family members of people killed in a terrorist attack. And as Sarah's parents told me, they weren't going around asking each other, oh, what did you get? And, you know, they didn't know. I told them, and it was one of the most painful parts of the reporting. I had assumed they knew that there were different amounts of compensation paid, but they didn't know. Really, the last thing you want to be thinking about is, hey, has some clever lawyer managed to sue somebody and get more for that family than for mine?
Just a brief mention about some of the things that happen in other countries. I was also absolutely astounded to read that if you are murdered in America, in a case of, for an example, the mass shooting in Las Vegas, The families got a lot of compensation because the gunman was in a hotel, so that hotel had insurance. But the gay men who died in the nightclub attack, was that in Florida?
Yes, the Pulse nightclub.
They got relatively nothing because it was an independent nightclub that wasn't part of a big chain.
And with the Las Vegas shooting, the man who perpetrated the attack had also researched shooting people from the top of a cliff, for example, or shooting people from an Airbnb. And if he'd done that, the families of the many people he killed would have got absolutely nothing because there's no one to sue. And actually, it's France, I think, that's got the system right, where the French government says, you know, you can't sue anybody, you can't sue car manufacturers, you can't sue car insurers. We are going to pay out, and we're not going to pay for the price of someone's life. We're going to pay for the costs of your bereavement. So if you lose a grandchild, you get a certain amount. If you lose a spouse, you get a certain amount. It's a reflection of what you are going through as someone who has lost someone.
Let's talk about drugs, because that was a fascinating chapter as well. And I think actually, you know, barring tragedy, it's where most people are going to encounter exactly what you're talking about in the book. Do I deserve, does my life deserve to have something spent on it? Mm. So can you tell us about the case of this extraordinary drug, the £1.8 million Zolgensma?
Zolgensma, yes. It's a gene therapy for a condition called SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, which is a very cruel disease. It's a genetically inherited disease. You're born with it. And babies born with SMA1, something like over 90% of them die by the time they're two. It's a motor neuron disease, so it's a wasting disease. The baby appears totally normal and then loses lots of its functions, muscular functions, and so can't swallow, can't crawl, can't walk,
can't cry loudly.
And so it's a really horrible thing to watch as a parent. And until very recently, there was no cure. You just watched your child very slowly die. And then there was a medication called Spinraza, which is incredibly expensive, that I think came out in 2015. And the NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, who decides which drugs to fund, was reluctant to fund Spinraza. Because it was so expensive. And then it eventually gave that the green light. And then this drug Zolgensma came along, which fixes the problem with the faulty gene with one dose. But one dose costs £1.8 million.
Right. So what do you want the reader to think when they get to that chapter? I felt very conflicted because, of course, I want Edward, it's the baby,
yes,
who you use as an example. Of course, I want his life to be valued. But also, just as a journalist and citizen of a large country that just seems to be struggling financially at the moment, you know that that can't be made available to everybody.
Of course. I mean, we live in a world of finite resources. The NHS has limited budgets and needs to make sure that they're being fair. But the other thing that I wanted to point out is that this £20,000 to £30,000 per life year in good health that the NHS is prepared to spend to keep you or me alive is also arbitrary. When I asked them where this number came from, I thought they were going to say, well, we have this budget of X billion a year and there are X million of us and we do the maths and that's how much we can afford. But it's actually just a number that is a convention. It's based on the cost of dialysis in the late 90s when this system was set up. And so this is how much the NHS is going to spend to save our lives, but it doesn't really come out of anywhere. It's just a kind of token that allows different diseases to be compared, a cancer drug to be compared with a gene therapy like this. It's amazing, really, that this kind of arbitrary number is a life or death figure that your or my life might depend on.
Yep. And all our lives are connected, aren't they? And let's end by talking about having a £23 manicure. what does that tell us about who's doing the manicure, what kind of life they might have, what they might be paid?
Yes. So there's a chapter about slavery, and I like getting my toenails done. And there's a place around the corner from where I live, where I've been going for a long time. And then I found that they only took cash even after the pandemic. And that made me feel a bit strange. All the people there were Vietnamese. There was the huge tragedy where so many Vietnamese people were killed in that lorry tragedy. And it made me think, oh my gosh, are these people being trafficked? How can it be financially viable for someone to spend over an hour doing my feet for £23 in London? And actually, I went back there as a kind of project, armed with all the advice that you're meant to bear in mind when you're seeing if people are trafficked. And I actually couldn't really tell. And I was sort of thinking, you know, this is a bit dodgy, but maybe they're just incredibly badly paid. And it made me realise there isn't actually, there's a very fine line between incredibly low pay and slavery. And all of us are prepared to turn a blind eye to it, or at least look away, if we are the beneficiary of it. And we are the beneficiaries of a lot of very dodgy labour. It's not just manicures and pedicures. It could be childcare. It could be getting your car washed cheaply. It could be the cleaner in your home. There are lots of questions that we have got used to not asking when there are affordable luxuries that are a little bit too good to be true. So we're all putting prices on lives and looking away from our actions as we do so.
Thank you very much indeed. The book is £16.99. That's quite a lot, Jenny.
I hope it's worth it. Good value.
Jenny Kleeman, and the book is out now at 17 quid, basically. You'll only get a penny change from it. And it's worth thinking, isn't it? You know, if you go for a kind of brag about how cheap your pedicure is, that's because somebody else isn't really able to brag about their life because it's costing them quite a lot more.
Yeah, I think we don't question this enough. I know, because it's too uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It really is, isn't it?
It is. I would highly recommend reading the book. I don't think it's one of those books, and I don't think Jenny would expect anybody to sit down and kind of read it all in one gulp.
No, I've got a copy. It's really interesting. It's one of those things you can dip into and be just fascinated by something on every page, yeah, genuinely.
And really learn some stuff along the way. And all of those compensation schemes, I think just that very simple point that no family is in the right place to then campaign for a change in a government policy when they're spending the rest of their life dealing with grief. So, you know, where is the impetus for that to be looked at and for that to change?
So the book is called?
The Price of Life.
And it's by Jenny Kleeman. Right, we are back tomorrow. I mean, it could be on the same day, because I know people who listen to three or four of these back to back.
Do you?
Yeah.
Are they all right?
No.
Well, get better soon.
Thank you very much for your emails. We love reading them. Can't thank you enough for taking part. Jane and Fee at times.radio.
Well done for getting to the end of another episode of Off Air with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Our Times radio producer is Rosie Cutler, and the podcast executive producer is Henry Tribe.
And don't forget, there is even more of us every afternoon on Times Radio. It's Monday to Thursday, 3 till 5. You can pop us on when you're pottering around the house or heading out in the car on the school run.
Or running a bank. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you can join us again on Off Air very soon.
Don't be so silly.
Running a bank?
I know, lady.
A lady listener.
I know, sorry.